It's Wednesday, May 11th, 2005. This is the House Special Committee on Budget, Subcommittee on Human Services and Public Safety. And today we get to focus on public safety areas. And so we'll have kind of introductory remarks from our LFO analyst, Doug Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, in front of you, in front of the members that have not been part of the joint committee, subcommittee on public safety, there is a large packet that Representative Richardson and Representative Boone have, which are basically the Phase 2 memos and the LFO write-ups, plus some information from the beginning of session. If others would like those, I have extra packets, but you probably have, Representative Wisnett, all these things already.
I'll take your write-ups, because I need to be sure I've got them all.
Okay. Well, I'll just hand you down a packet then.
I've got them in there. Thank you.
The other thing that I wanted just to, and this is for Representative Richardson and Boone again, this was at the beginning of session, public safety system, people from around the system came in, gave a joint presentation. In fact, you were there, that's right, it was Human Services too. And that is a good overview, and I'll make sure Representative Boone gets this. Here's a copy for you if you've lost it. Again, I have a couple extra copies, but this is a good background piece by many people in the public safety. It was put together by both state and local folks. So that is another very useful document. In the Phase 2 memos, in that larger packet, Mr. Chair, are a number of things around major issues that are facing the public safety area. We'll hear a lot of it today on probably two of the largest issues on population management and the Madras Prison issue and Department of Corrections and Community Corrections, and even Representative Wisnett and Hannah, there are some new things that the department, myself, and others have been taking a look at as options around some of the financing on the Madras Prison that are potential options for reducing costs and phasing in, you know, different start times, and they will be going through some general options today. And with that, Mr. Chair, unless there are specific questions, I'll be glad to invite Department of Corrections to come to the table for their presentation.
Let's go ahead with that. Dr. Williams.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having us here this afternoon. We're pleased to be here to talk to you about the Department of Corrections issues involving the budget, population management, and also issues involving alternatives associated with the proposed Madras prison construction that's been identified in the governor's budget, as well as information on community corrections. For the record, I'm Max Williams, the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Seated to my left is Sue Acuff, who is our budget and planning administrator, and to my right, Ginger Martin, who is our assistant director of transitional services, who also has responsibility in her portfolio for the community corrections operations of the department. And we'll have some conversation with you here in just a few moments about community corrections related issues that Ginger is going to lead you through. We've prepared a very brief packet, which I believe you have, or if not, is being distributed. This is a very brief overview. Representative Hannah and Wisnett participated in the Phase 1 and Phase 2 presentations of the department's budget, and we were pretty certain they didn't want to experience all of that over again. So what we've done with this sheet is really to try to target staff's recommendation, specifically some issues that we thought you would be interested in. At the very high level of overview, what you have in these first few slides is just some general information about the department. Our mission statement, which is in fact to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. You have the April population forecast numbers from where we are today at slightly less than 13,000 individuals incarcerated as projected through 2015, which is over 17,000 inmates is what the current projection is. A brief description of what the mechanics are that drives the prison population, which is really the number of inmates times the length of a sentence, and then the impact of what changes in sentencing law does to that prison population over time. And obviously the most significant impact was the 1994 Measure 11 that introduced mandatory minimum sentences and the impact that that's had, and that's reflected in a slide that we'll show you in a moment. The history of sentencing policy just gives you a brief description of the sentencing policy changes, moving from a straight parole-based system before 1989 through a number of changes that made more specific and more uniform sentencing policy around the state, as well as mandatory sentences for certain crimes, both under Measure 11 and certain repeat property offenders. Now, if you'll turn to the slides on page 3, this gives you a bit of a historical perspective as well as we sort of lead into this conversation. Again, these numbers have been updated from the October forecast, which was what our budget was built on, which was the October forecast. And for those of you who don't know, and I'm sure most of you do, that the prison population forecast is not prepared by the Department of Corrections, but is actually prepared independently by the Office of Economic Analysis and the Department of Administrative Services. So their economist team has developed a model, Sue Porter, over the years, a model for how to forecast prison population, but at least in the last three biennia, her April forecast, given in session, has been accurate within one percentage point, plus or minus.
Question on the two graphs. First, in the bottom graph, it shows flat for 04, and then for 05 goes back up again. Why would there have been a flat point for a year?
If you look at the 04 flat, what we believe that is an indication of, and was reflected again in the changes that were made from the October to the April forecast, was the introduction of the alternative incarceration program. AIP was something that the 2003 legislature approved. It took about a year or so for AIP to operate. It is a intensive drug and alcohol treatment cognitive restructuring program delivered at three separate institutions, but primarily at the Powder River Institution in Baker City, and then also for females at the Wilsonville facility. It's a program that once an inmate is in and successfully completes the A&D treatment and the cognitive restructuring program, they then can be released early on 90-day transitional leave. And if they successfully complete that transitional leave back out in the community without violating the terms and conditions of their release, they receive a reduction in sentence that averages somewhere around 12 months. Originally, because it was a new program, Sue Porter and DAS, as they were preparing the estimate, weren't exactly sure how to account for it in the population forecast. What it did, I think, in that year is, as the program became operational, was having the first impact of releasing those individuals back to the community with the reduction in sentence, it created a bit of a flat there in the forecast. And that's been essentially accounted for now in her April forecast, because once the program is essentially fully implemented, it becomes sort of static then in the numbers that go through it and doesn't really affect the change based on the additional bodies coming into the system. So we believe, and she believes, that she's now appropriately accounted for the impact of that program, but we think that's what describes a little bit of the flatness.
What's the percentage of recidivism of released criminals?
On that program or overall?
Well, if it's overall, if the graph shows no change, then it says that this program's not doing any good. If the program has any potential to do good, then it means it would lower the recidivism, and therefore you would have a lessening of your population than you would have without the program.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the program in its maximum capacity only affects, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 or so inmates. So it's a 200 to 250 inmates out of a population of almost 13,000. 1,000 inmates. So it wouldn't have a direct impact on its recidivism, wouldn't potentially change our overall recidivism numbers to the degree that would be reflected, as you've described, over time. Also, recidivism is a trailing indicator. So we measure recidivism based on a new felony committed within 3 years. So the impact on our recidivism numbers with respect to AIP, we're really not going to know for probably another 2 years. Now, we can track those individuals independently and get some sense of how they're performing, but its overall impact is going to be something that is going to take a little longer for us to be able to determine, because that recidivism number is a trailing indicator. We believe everything, at least currently, is showing us that the AIP program is actually being effective, and that people who are participating in AIP are coming back less often than people essentially of the same type and category with the same crime background that aren't participating in the AIP program. So we think we've got something that's working, and we're very excited about it, but we also are very cautious about overpromising its effects until we've had the opportunity to really work the data through.
Okay. On the top graph, can you explain the deviation in 1997?
I can explain the deviation that begins in 1997. Essentially, what you had there was the passage of Senate Bill 1145, which created the county-ran community corrections program. It was at that point that the determination was made that offenders who were convicted of a felony but would be serving less than 12 months would remain and do that service in county jails as opposed to coming into the state. And that accounted for that small downturn that you see through 97 and 98, as felons that otherwise would have been coming into the correction system for short periods of time stayed at the county level, and only the 12-month or more convicted felons would be coming into the Department of Corrections. And again, you'll see that that was a short-lived sort of bubble that then started to run up the other direction. And by and large, the growth from 98 forward has remained on a fairly steady trajectory upward.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, can I just insert something here to add to what the director was saying? The treatment programs are working really well, and we toured the Baker City facility and some of the additional, talked to some people who work with these guys directly, and they're really excited about it and talking about expanding if they can, and also the treatment program at Coffee Creek for the women and the parenting programs that are going on there are working extremely well. And I used to be a person who was pretty much lock them up and leave them there. And I have been slowly over the years been being turned around, working with some of these parenting programs and with the Children's of Incarcerated Parents program and my service on the Children's Trust Fund and what they're doing with the Children's Justice Alliance. And it's been very, very impressive. And I am I'm a believer, I'll put it this way. And I think it's the only way we can turn that tide and flatten that graph.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, we appreciate your comments. It's consistent with the department's philosophy as we reorganize to create a transitional services division and to focus more of our attention on trying to make that period of reentry and our overall implementation of the Oregon accountability model to accomplish just that. When one considers that 95% of the population that we have will eventually release back out into the community, we have to find some way to make that more effective. And certainly our children's programs, where we recognize that you've got about an eight times more chance of being in prison if you've got a parent in prison, and breaking that intergenerational cycle of crime is a significant challenge, but one that we think is going to be one of the things that will help turn that tide that you see reflected on these graphs. So we appreciate your comments and your enthusiasm. We're enthusiastic about both those programs as well. So that gives you a sense of an overview. The last slide, obviously, is just the estimated impact of Measure 11, both historical and then moving forward. You can see the portion of the graph with the hatch marks is the direct impact, which are direct sentences associated with sentence length increases associated with Measure 11, accounting for bed space within the institutions. The gray portion at the bottom is what's referred to as indirect impact. Those are sentences that were enhanced as a result of the possibility that if they hadn't fled out to something, that they would have likely gotten a Measure 11 a sentence. And so as a result, it's accounted for in the indirect impact portion. But that gives you some suggestion of the the impact. And you can see that we have right now somewhere in the neighborhood of almost, well, between 3,000 and 4,000 inmates within the system that are currently serving Measure 11 sentences, so a substantial portion of our population. The next thing that we wanted to do...
Thursday, wasn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, in testimony to the Joint Committee, Mr. Steve Dole made a comment that 75% of the people that have committed a crime are not in jail or convicted of a crime. Is that?
Or commit a felony.
I would assume, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I would assume that his reference was, and I don't remember being present when that testimony was given, so I can't be certain what he was referring to. But my assumption is that that's a reference to the fact that while we have 13,000 individuals that are currently incarcerated, almost 13,000 in state, there are another 30,000 that are under the jurisdiction of community corrections, either on felony probation or post-prison supervision, that are being supervised at the community level by community corrections offices. On top of that, and he may not have been including these, but on top of that, there's also a number of counties who have on their own chosen to also supervise misdemeanor offenders, and so that number actually adds to that 30,000. So it might have been a reference to that combination of individuals who are being supervised as a result of having committed a crime, but aren't. Some of those were incarcerated, served their period of incarceration, and are now under community supervision. Some portion of them who are on felony probation were sentenced to some level of probation prior to incarceration, or maybe never being incarcerated, but serve under being supervised by the parole and probation offices in the counties where they reside.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I took from his comment, I think what his point was he was trying to make, Director Williams, and you can comment on, is that the people in prison need to be in prison. There's people that have committed crimes that are not in prison or on probation or whatever, but those people that are in prison, no, we're bad guys and women.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, obviously our job is to implement the sentences administered by the court once a conviction has been entered, and that's who we have. By and large, everyone we have has been convicted of committing a felony whose determination at sentencing was that they would serve for more than a year or they don't come into our system. So I would tell you that if there was a group of individuals within our system that I have the greatest concern about their best location, and it's not that they ought not be somewhere, it would be those who have a significant mental health issue who also have been convicted of committing a crime. They need to be someplace for their own safety and for the safety of the public. I wonder at times, given the intensity of the mental health issues that we have, whether some of those individuals are best served by being in an institutional environment in a prison setting, or if they could be better served somewhere else. But again, that's not a determination we are entitled to make. They come to us with a sentence having been issued by the court. They make determinations themselves and with their lawyers at the time that they choose whether to potentially go under the jurisdiction of the PSRB or plead or not plead, and where they end up. And once we have them, we do the very best we can with them once we have them in the system. But yes, everybody in our system has been sentenced to more than 12 months in prison for the commission of some crime. The other thing I'd say is 70% of everybody we have on average has some alcohol or substance abuse related addiction that is a contributor to their overall criminality. So holding them accountable for their actions and not excusing that behavior is absolutely essential, I think, if you're going to run a criminal justice system that meets the needs of the public in ensuring public safety. At the same time, failing to address those addiction needs and finding a methodology to try to address that both internally within the department and then at the time of release back in a community is an invitation, frankly, I think, to have those people, not having dealt with their addiction, to go out and commit additional crimes and victimize additional Oregonians, and is a risk to our public safety. So I fully fully agree that they should be there, but I also believe that once they're there, we should be doing things to make it as least likely as possible that they'll come back once we release them back out into the community.
Thank you. Representative Hem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, I know we've touched on this before, but those that you speak of with significant mental health issues, of the total population, what are their numbers of the DOC population?
We believe, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, we believe that we have approximately 14% of our overall population that has severe or acute mental illness. Those who are on some level of mental health supervision or receiving mental health services inside our system, it's more like 23 or 24%. But 14% of them we determine to be severe or acute. Now, I wouldn't even suggest to you that all of those 14% ought to be somewhere other than where they're at. Someone can have and engage in criminal behavior with all of the requisite intent and still have a mental illness, and prison might still be the appropriate spot for that individual, even if and with their mental illness. But I would tell you that I believe that there are people that we have who could be better served either with additional mental health resources from us or in cooperation with the Oregon State Hospital, and we're engaged in those longer term discussions with them right now.
Follow up, please. Again, back to some prior discussion and further thoughts now, you know, let's say there's about 1,500 people out of that group. Have you or will you determine at some point the need to have a facility specifically for that type of prisoner rather than those folks scattered among the general population around the entire DOC system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, we're in the middle of sort of having those long-term planning conversations now. It seems in some respects like that would be a simple solution. And what we've identified through a Managing Mental Illness in Prison Task Force that we initiated about a year ago, actually, the report of which has been provided to the committee, I think, early in our presentation, that what we lack is a strong continuum of care environment. We have very few beds for our acute care situation across the system, and then when those people who have been in those acute beds have to be triaged out, they often go back into the general population or with not a lot of step-down opportunities. And so what we're trying to do, given our current resources, is to build an approach that would allow for some intermediate mental health locations for these people to be, where additional services would be made available and the right kind of training existed. One of the things that I've learned is that to try to make the system run as efficiently as possible, we don't replicate every set of services at every institution. And so sometimes you end up in an institution because the services that are at that institution can provide for you. So, for example, if you have kidney malfunction, regardless whether you're a minimum security or medium security or, frankly, even a death row inmate, if you have a kidney malady that requires dialysis, you will be at our Two Rivers facility in Umatilla because that's where our dialysis unit is located. What you find with a mental health population, the size we're talking about, is all of them have a variety of needs. And so to take all of them and house them in one sole facility would mean that facility would have to essentially replicate almost everything else by way of both program, work opportunity, all health services related kinds of things that we have spread out around the system right now to try to maximize those resources. So it becomes a bit of a challenge because mental health often isn't the only challenge this person has. They often have co-occurring disorders with a number of other issues and health related issues on top of that. So it's a thorny problem, but one that we're working very hard on, and with our partners, including NAMI and the Oregon Advocacy Center and others who were participants with us in this task force and who have helped us develop the recommendations.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could now, I'd like to sort of take us into the discussion about sort of the second issue that Mr. Wilson asked that we address with you in our conversation briefly this afternoon, and that's our population management issues, specifically with respect to how we're managing the conversation around MADRS. As you'll see, the next sheet, it's one page back in front, and it's a lot of words. I'll just try to walk you through this in a fairly quick way and take your questions, but sort of lay out the background for you. As the forecast suggests, we'll have a 7.9% increase in the 05-07 budget, and so we have asked the legislature to approve our construction of the facility at MADRS and the expansion of the Coffee Creek facility, which is 324 beds at our women's facility. While the forecast for men has sort of flattened during this period of time, the female forecast and intakes are continuing to run above the forecasted levels. So the rate of increase of females coming into our system is higher than the forecast and continues to run at that rate. We have currently 1,000 inmates around our system that are housed in temporary and emergency beds that have been crowded into existing facilities. We hit that number over this last biennium as a result of the delay of MADRS that was done in the last legislative session. In the next biennium, we'll net out to an additional increase of about 1,000 inmates, and then we'll achieve almost 5,000, 4,600 inmates, as the forecast predicts, over the next 10 years if there are no changes made significantly in any sentencing policy. What we have provided for you then below is a review of alternatives that we want the committee to be aware of in the conversations that we have been having, what the impact of those alternatives would be. The first one really is, so the one identified as number one, is really approval of the plan as identified in the governor's budget. This would approve us to begin and frankly continue with the construction of MADRS to meet our current time obligations, which would be bringing the minimum facility online in December 2006, and then a year behind that we would open the medium facility in 2007. It gives you the information about how much current authority that we have, which is the $58 million number, and what the total cost of the project would be. And together, it would have 864 beds of minimum custody and 1,240 beds of medium custody. The pros of this are that we could open on time, and given the way we are currently managing our population, we believe that it would limit the rental beds to the 80 or so beds that we have currently rented from counties, and would maximize all the beds currently available within the system. The downside, obviously, is that it's going to cost you some general fund money to do that in this biennium, and we've identified that amount for you. There's $13.4 million for the debt service, and then the startup funding of the additional facility would be $6.9 million. It also identifies, when you compare this to startup and operating costs of the new facility, to just the option of renting beds, if you could rent all the beds, and we used a very conservative number of $60 a day. Most of our calculations use that number. I would tell you that upward pressure that we've been experiencing on that number would suggest to us that it's not a realistic number over time, and I think Mr. Wilson can provide you some additional information on that. But even if you use that $60 a day number, you know, as compared to an option of bed rentals at $9.9 million, it saves you some money in the short term. What I've asked and what I would hope that the committee would be willing to do, is difficult as it is to look beyond just this single biennium, because what you'll see is that a delay of MADRS until the next biennium, if you look at both the 05-07 and the 07-09, actually costs you more money in the long run. The project costs go up. They go up as a result of increased pressure on overall construction costs, and the impact of having to rent beds for a longer period of time ultimately drives you to where you're spending $15.5 million more to essentially get the same project, even by the time you get to the second biennium. So that takes you through sort of the puts and takes associated with option one, which is essentially the thing that's been laid out in the governor's recommended budget. Option two came as a result of communications with both legislators and with legislative staff and the Department of Administrative Services to talk about some other methodologies of how we might try to provide some sort of a reduction in the impact on the general fund and still move forward in a timeline that would make some sense for both the budget and for the department. What this is essentially a you would capitalize the debt associated with the sale of the COPs so that initial debt cost would be rolled in essentially the finance cost. This is not a new concept and has been done actually by the department before in the construction of other facilities during difficult budget times. Option number two also would delay the operation of the minimum facility until September of 2007. So what you would build essentially now and stick on our current construction cycle, that way avoiding the upward pressure on the construction costs, but you would simply then put off the opening of the facility and push the most of the startup and the operation costs into the next biennium. The impact would be that it would require us to substantially increase the number of rental beds, and that takes the rental bed number under the forecast up to 580 rental beds, which, excluding the conversation which we can have here if you'd like to about the Wapato facility, if you look around at what we believe are the rest of the available county beds, achieving the 580 is not a guarantee. We think we can probably do it with the cooperation of the counties, but it would be a challenge to achieve that number given the conversation that we've had, and it would likely not be at $60 a day.
Chair. Mr. Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, when you talk about 580 beds or any of the 80 beds or any of the various, you're saying up to a maximum of, is there some type of a schedule that you would need 40 in August, 160 in October? I mean, is it ramped up so that the 580 number is like the day before you open Madras, and it's somewhat proportionately less the rest of the time through the biennium?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that's exactly how it works. You wouldn't go out and rent all 580 beds on day one. You would add
and
them.
And conceivably on something like a Wapato rental, you don't need all 500 at once.
Yeah, conceivably you would not want all 500 beds at once. You would want to bring them online. And we do the same thing.
Fortunately, it's pretty hard to rent that big of a facility for the first guy you need to put in.
Right. That's where it becomes economically challenging. But even when we open a new facility, we don't typically fill it on day one and turn on the switch. We bring, as the population grows, we collect enough inmates to economically open and staff a unit and bring that unit on board and the people on board associated with managing that unit. And then you do the same thing as the system starts to grow. And so we do it in a way that conserves the resources of the budget as much as possible. So the 580 is where we believe we would top out at, and then once it started to open, those numbers would decline, although you wouldn't in 07-09 ever get out of, even with the Madras beds coming online, you would never completely get out of having some number of rental beds operating through the balance of the 07-09 biennium. There would still be, you couldn't open them fast enough, essentially, to overtake your need to have some rental beds for some period of that time. And we could give you a more detailed schedule if you'd like to see how that goes. We'll be happy to share that with you. What I wanted to point out is on the pros on this approach, obviously, is that it does allow us to essentially get the construction done and at the price that we've essentially currently believe we have estimates on that are accurate, and it will delay the increase of the construction cost by $14.3 million. Capitalize the debt on the remaining COP sales will save $12,554,624 in general fund. So that's essentially a 12 $6.5 million contribution back to the general fund if you go ahead and do this capitalization. And then the impact on the general fund with respect to operating costs would be $9.9 million less. So you combine these two figures together, and you know, you're talking some fairly significant general fund reduction by doing it under this sort of a capitalization and nine-month delay in operating. It will cost the general fund roughly $10 million more during the 07-09 biennium because you're essentially shifting those delay in operating expenses forward into the next biennium. So,
what is your feeling about having private prison facilities constructed if the law were changed?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would tell you that I think that we aren't in a situation where I would be in a position to recommend the use of private facilities. At least my, and by no means, you know, a year and 4 months on this job, you know, makes me a worldwide expert on this. But in my observation and communication with other states that have gone down that path, you know, there's been the savings are sometimes overpromised, and I would tell you that I think the institutional challenges associated with companies that have to operate a prison system in order to make a profit typically result in reductions of the bottom line that include everything from salaries for staff to the food that the inmates are served to a variety of issues that ultimately ends up potentially being a more dangerous, less public safety-focused environment. And I'm sure there are those in the private prison industry who would disagree with my assessment, but I think that the other thing that happens is that, and several states have experienced this, where after a contract's been entered into, there's been a determination by the company that it can't make money at the contract that it negotiated, and so it tends to, they walk away occasionally from a facility. So anytime that an agency is going to be operating in that fashion, you have to build in a significant amount of redundancy to be able to be ultimately responsible for that population, even if the private entity chooses not to be there anymore or to walk off the field. When you start to build in that redundancy into your equation, it becomes less economical, and the savings typically aren't nearly as great as they were originally projected. That's my sort of off-the-cuff assessment thus far about that conversation. And it's one that we haven't, at least till now in this session, has not been something that's really been discussed or explored to any great degree.
Things you mentioned, I've read, have occurred, but that there are a number of states that are functioning and are doing fine with it. The one thing that I have read that's consistent is that the cost in growth, the increase in expenses, has been lowered by about 4%, and it seems to be some kind of a competitive factor, but it does seem to have at least that one positive aspect, is that the increased cost over time seems to be less where there is a public and private system going on in the same state. Just was wondering if it had been discussed, since I'm new in this area.
Sure. And Mr. Chair, that's not data that I've actually had a chance to review. If you'd like me to take a look at whatever it was that you were reading, I'd be happy to look at it and we could comment back to you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think if the options were to start having to go out of state, if we exceed in terms of rental beds, the likely option for that would be renting out of state private beds, something that the law does not allow right now in Oregon. And I think Max or Mr. Williams will talk about that in a minute. But even in all these alternatives, that there is always that potential for having to rent out-of-state private beds.
Right. And I'll touch on that in as we talk about number three. As you see on number two, as we've identified the cons, the 580 beds that we will have to rent is probably going to strain slightly the number of available rental beds in state, although we believe it's probably doable. And we believe that $60 a day number that we've sort of built into our estimates is not a realistic number as the upward pressure would start to exist on these available rental beds. And then obviously anytime you capitalize debt service, it simply adds to the long-term cost of the operation, which is sort of an economic and policy choice that the legislature would have to make. But it can't not point that out, I think. The last issue, or the last alternative that we've given you information here, essentially is the assuming the two-year delay of MADRS. It also, the numbers here reflect, if you do the two-year delay, it assumes a lease of the Wapato facility for 5 years. And we're assuming in that that the agreement can be reached and that the conditional use permit changes could be made and that the facility would actually, that the alterations could be made and that all that could happen by July 2006. So that's all built into these assumptions, which I would tell you would make me very uncomfortable if we would actually have to prove those up. But for purposes of the discussion here today, we assumed those assumptions. This alternative would cost the general fund during the 05-07 $1 to $2 million more than alternative number two. So it's a more expensive option, actually, than even your capitalization cost. Your general fund in this biennium, it's a more expensive alternative. And unfortunately, it also drives your construction costs, which go up by nearly $40 million by the time we're into the next 05-07 biennium, or excuse me, 07-09 biennium, talking about mm-hmm. construction. The delayed approval pushes the opening dates out substantially. So a two-year delay is really a four-year delay because it takes us about 2 years to construct these facilities. So you get a sense as a result of that delay, if you look at the forecast, even if you use the Wapato facility, so even assuming we could use all 525 beds of Wapato under this analysis, DOC would rent another 1,180 beds. So if we rented all the Wapato beds and we rented all of the county beds other than Wapato that we thought were available, which was between the 480 and the 580 number, we would still have 700 beds that we would have to find for inmates, and that would require us to go out of state and likely out of state to privately ran systems, which is where available capacity would be. And that would require that you change the current statute, because currently we're not allowed to place inmates in out-of-state rental beds in anything other than a publicly ran facility.
Okay. And while you can meet, has there been any discussion about actually purchasing Wapato? I've only read where it's the possibility of renting it. It's already built, it's empty. Do you know if there's been discussion about actually buying it from?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we went down a number of alternatives. We have a large book we prepared on sort of alternatives analysis with respect to Wapato, which we'd be pleased to share with you, that would also lay out sort of the ramifications of the purchase. The county built it. It's got... they funded it with bonds, so there are a number of, I think, legal impediments, along with the fact that it ultimately resulted in being built out at a purchase price somewhere around $50-some-odd million. So it turned out to be a fairly expensive operation. So to get out what they paid for it would be more than it would cost us, Mr. Chair, to go build our own. So it wouldn't, you know, it's a short way of saying it wouldn't be a good investment of your dollar, in our opinion, to buy it.
Okay, Representative Hanson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on the county commission when a lot of the planning for that was taking place, and it was an adventure. And it's in my district. So I'm pretty familiar with it. It's a very expensive facility for a couple of reasons. One, where it's located, and sites to build a prison, jail, any type of correction facility in Multnomah County are incredibly limited because of proximity to neighbors and neighborhoods and stuff. That piece of property, we purchased it from the port. In order for the port to be a willing seller for property, they gave us like the option to buy the most isolated piece of property in Rivergate, which also had incredible costs to develop utilities into the site. Now, as more development occurs, there could very possibly be some repayments and stuff on those utilities over a long period of time, but certainly the upfront cost to get utilities into that site, roads, sewers, water, drove the cost of the land and the acquisition up to a significant degree. I see the biggest barrier is the conditional use permit. Now, we can make a lot of cases for some reasonable changes to that. I think we could. There's a potential of talking to the neighbors and talking to the various groups that helped to negotiate those original permits. And I would love to see that facility utilized. But from a standpoint, from a state perspective, all it takes is one citizen, one group, one organization that is unhappy with the changes that are being advocated in the conditional use permit, because it's a land use decision, to appeal it to LUBA. Whether it's frivolous or real or whatever, you add a timeline, an indeterminate timeline, into your ability to go forward and actually use it. If everything goes right, it could probably be a pretty workable thing. But there's no assurance that that timeline could be met because of the potential for an appeal of the land use decision. And that makes, if you're looking at the timing of when you can get the beds and you need them at particular times, it's not a very realistic alternative.
I assume that since it's already there, that a lot of that had already been worked out.
Well, it was cited with a conditional use permit of some of the conditions that are on it is that it be run as a jail, not as a prison. And the definition is pretty, that would have to be changed.
It's okay.
Yeah.
You know what?
Okay.
I got you.
In other words, it ain't option three, probably ain't going to work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, we appreciate, particularly because of your own experience with the site, you making some of those points. I want to say that it has been our pleasure to work with Multnomah County and to open our information and then to open their information and to look at all the alternatives we could to determine whether there was a way for us and I believe what the governor wanted us to do, which was to examine whether or not there was any way to make it work. And we will continue to respond to any set of suggestions or review that anybody has for us to do, and continue to work with them. But for the long term and even the short term need to meet the current population forecast, it's difficult with those caveats surrounding that facility to feel as though we could know for a certainty that those beds would be available when we would need them. And as a protection of your general fund dollar, which is something that we feel obligated to do as well, certain alternatives are just going to be more expensive, and that's a policy choice that you get to make, but we need to at least lay out for you what those alternatives are and what the overall cost ultimately to the general fund would be if you chose them. The two points I just want to make on this last one, along with the need to change the statute to house the inmates out of state, there is, and I know this seems perhaps less important, but I can't not say it, is the overall impact to our system when we're managing that many inmates, both in rental beds, out of state and in state. It becomes very, very difficult to deliver the level of program and the continuity and consistency of program when you have that many inmates spread across so many different facilities. And logistically, it becomes a real challenge for the department. The last time the department had inmates who were out of state and housed in private facilities, there were a number of problems, including escapes from some of those private facilities that ultimately the department could potentially still bear liability for, is that they're ultimately in our custody even if they're under contract being housed in some other state. On top of that, inmates frankly didn't like to be away from their families, and so the focus we had on trying to reunite people and make people have a relationship that was going to sustain them and be consistent when they were released back to the community resulted in people going out of state, and then even well-behaved inmates, because that's ultimately the only people you can send out of state, are typically people who are well-behaved and don't have high mental health or medical needs, because that's usually negotiated into the contract. Because they didn't like being in Arizona or they didn't like being in Texas, they would then act out in a way that ultimately would get them shipped back to Oregon, even if they were going to spend some period of time in a disciplinary sanction as a result of that, simply because they knew if they were enough of a behavior problem, they could self-select themselves to come back to the system. So what you had was a lot of expense associated with those kinds of issues that are difficult to frankly account for, but that ultimately drive up both the cost of operating your system and the effectiveness you have in trying to deliver program accountability, reentry services, and other things to that inmate population. finally, if you're going to spend out-of-state money, our estimate is that it would, to rent these rental beds out-of-state, it would be during that period of time about $14.6 million, which would be general fund money essentially being shipped out-of-state. And the impact of that, if you're going to spend that $14.6 million one way or the other, because the population is going to come and is going to have to be served, you know, there's at least some benefit to spending that money internally within Oregon, where it produces additional income and tax revenue and the like to offset some of the state's own expense associated with having to manage this population. So, and we've identified that. The last portion, which I won't go through in any detail for you, just lays out what some of the impacts are. I know we've been involved in numerous conversations about issues regarding possible sentencing changes and what the impact would be. We're happy to engage in those conversations and provide you any information you might be interested in. The impact is, depending on which flavor of sentencing reform you want to apply, doesn't really have much of an effect in the immediate, unless you went quite significantly into the current population who's already been sentenced. If you're talking about applying it prospectively to new people who are being sentenced going forward, you can do that. It just is a slower, it's a slower cycle before you start to see an impact on that on population growth. Otherwise, you have to apply it essentially to a population that's already been sentenced, and then there are issues involving whether or not they would have to go back to court for resentencing and other issues that would need to be explored. But we've given you some of that information there, knowing that it's a conversation that continues to occur and one that we're pleased to engage in at some point if you'd like us to.
Okay, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll say this briefly because I think I know you understand, but I also had an opportunity to meet with Multnomah County, several of the Multnomah County commissioners, along with the sheriff, the vice chair of the Ways and Means Budget Committee, in vetting out many of the issues surrounding Wapato, and I have a lot of information. Anything else you would want to know? We went through a number of these issues, including the land use restrictions and so forth. I could be helpful with you on that. Director Williams, in item two, does your assumption about rental beds there have anything to do with Wapato? When you say up to the 400, 580 rental beds, is that any use of Wapato?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, we excluded from that analysis Wapato, assuming essentially sort of bringing on rental beds as they were needed and using our $60 per day estimate, okay, which is considerably lower than would be able to rent the Wapato bed.
Representative Henson.
Well, certainly, if some portion of Wapato was opened as a jail to be used by Multnomah County, I think that would have a potential of freeing up more rental beds in other facilities in Multnomah County. The $60 a day would be real problematic.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, and I'm not entirely clear, having read some of the newspaper accounts of the communications between the city and the county on an agreement to open up some of those pods at the Inverness Jail, whether or not once those are open, that most of what they had as available rental beds in Inverness might be used up as a result of that agreement. So I don't know where they would be with respect to freeing up other beds within the system. But we currently have been having conversations with Multnomah County at renting beds from them from their Inverness system at a price point less than what the Wapato beds would cost, something more akin to, I think, about a $68 a day cost associated with those beds, and are continuing to, you know, sort of engage them in that dialogue as well as we look, you sort of move forward and try to figure out where we're going to go and what the forecast would be. Part of the overall 480 to 580 beds that we would rent if we were to do option two, we had assumed that some beds would be available in Multnomah County for rental to achieve that number.
I think Grants Pass was offering 30-some beds for $63 a day, and I think LFO's analysis of the GRB was at $64 a day. But
Mr. Chair, we've been working with mostly the jail managers around the state. It's a fluid it's a fluid situation. As beds become available, we engage in those conversations, and then in some instances, counties have since come up with some of their own resources, so beds that were available even at the beginning of the session have now been, a county has come up with some other money and has decided to open their own beds for their own purposes, and those beds have gone off the table. Other places, beds have come on the table. So it's one of those things that we really sort of manage on a month-to-month basis as to what's out there and what's available and what the county has plans for.
Okay. Christian Hansen.
Well, those, virtually all of those beds are needed locally. It's just local government can't afford to operate.
Right.
I just, there was an article today, Clackamas County was going to have to close 76 beds in their next year's budget. By the same token, in terms of local government, is kind of reluctant to make long-term commitments on those beds because they are needed locally if they can get the, if there's some way to get the,
right,
the funding, and they operate on annual budgets.
Our last issue, Mr. Chair, was to just give you a brief understanding of where we are at in conversations with respect to community corrections, the community corrections funding. And as I said before, with me, seated to my right, is Ginger Martin, who's the Assistant Director of Transitional Services, and is going to sort of be leading you through a conversation about community corrections funding options and alternatives. So I'll turn it over to Ginger, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, members of the committee, Ginger Martin, Department of Corrections. I wanted to walk through some of the various budget numbers that are being discussed for community corrections grants, but before I do that, let me just establish a little bit of a basic understanding about what that pays for. Community corrections grants pay for the supervision and community interventions and community-based sanctions for all felony offenders on community supervision in Oregon. So that includes felony probation and also those who have been to prison and are now out on supervision, on post-prison supervision or parole. And finally, it includes that group of offenders who previously spent 12 months in prison and are now spending their prison sentence at the local level. Proportionally, the vast majority of the folks of the 30,000 who fall into those groups are on either probation or post-prison supervision. A very small number, 4.5% or so generally, fall into what we call the local control group, and that's that group that used to come to prison. Community corrections agencies generally evaluate the risk to reoffend of each offender who comes into the office, and they will supervise those offenders who are at higher risk to reoffend more closely. They typically invest more of their community-based resources in terms of both treatment and sanctions in those higher risk people, as well as their officer time. All of the community corrections agencies employ a variety of community-based punishments and also interventions. Community-based punishments include things like community service work, work release type programs, day reporting centers, electronic house arrest, and of course jail is a community-based sanction. The programs that are typically used, almost every county has some investment in alcohol and drug treatment for their offenders. Sex offender treatment, mental health treatment, cognitive programs are the most common, some employment programs. I've included in the packet the corrections population forecast from April for the community corrections populations, and this is that entire group, so it includes both the folks, all the folks on probation, all the folks on post-prison, and the local control group. And you see that it is slowly rising over time as well, though it tends not to rise as quickly as the prison population. You probably are curious what happened with that dip in the history. That was a result of the budget reductions in defense and the court system at the end of last biennium, and a whole lot of activity stopped at that time. And so we saw a big drop in probation and also in post-prison supervision because there wasn't the defense there to represent those folks. And so they postponed dealing with some cases until the new biennium and dealt with some.
What's the justification for a graph between now and the 14th that is so much sharper than the historical graph between 2000 and 2005?
Chair Richardson, the primary drivers of the community corrections caseload are the post-prison group. So as we send more people to prison, more people get out, and so that's incorporated into that. I think that's the primary driver in some property crime. And this is the forecast that the Office of Economic Analysis does for corrections populations. They do both the prison forecast and the field forecast.
Okay.
They were as...
Comment on that? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
It shoots up, and so it's easy to have numbers, but what's the justification for it?
And I haven't actually put a straight edge on it and sort of tried to do my own little plot here, but I think that if you sort of plot it, what you'll see is that if you took out the little dip, that it is growing at a fairly consistent rate. It does start to peak up a little bit there as you get maybe halfway around January 09. It starts to get a little bit steeper. I think, as Ms. Martin explained, because you're talking about as you incarcerate more people will be on post-prison supervision upon release. So as we grow the prison population from 13,000 to almost 18,000 over the next 10 years, as that larger population comes out, and I try to sometimes remind people, and it shouldn't be complicated, it sometimes is, to think about the 13,000 people that we have in prison, or almost 13,000 people that we have in prison today, aren't the same 13,000 people we're going to have in prison a year from now. We release on average about 4,000 inmates annually. So there's a turnover in that population. So over the course of a biennium, although we might have 12,000 people, between 12 and 13 as our number of inmates incarcerated, we're constantly releasing and getting new people in. So the people who move through our system in a biennium might be closer to 18,000 people that have moved actually through the system or been at least at some part of the biennium served as an inmate within the system. So as that population starts to go up to, between 13 to 18,000 people, you've got that group of 4,000 people, then to 5,000, then maybe to 6,000 people typically cycling through the system on an annual basis that are being released back out into the community. And as those larger post-prison populations grow for supervision, you're going to see some rate of increase in that population. I think the other thing that I would tell you is that this is probably based, as Ginger mentioned as well, to some growth in the property crimes rate.
As well, when I look at January 00 and January 02 and January 05, and they all look very close. And then starting in 05, we start to ramp up. And since the projections determine the cost, then I just would like to make sure that the projections are based on something rational, because the cost will follow the projections.
And perhaps the best thing for us to do, Mr. Chair, is to ask Sue Porter at the Office of Economic Analysis to specifically respond to your question. Yeah, we'd be pleased to convey that to her, and I know Mr. Wilson can do that as well from a staff perspective, but we'll communicate with her as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the forecasting methodology actually tracks individual prisoner or inmates in prison and individuals out in the community. So it is sort of what you're forecasting, the margin of error forecasting is sort of just trying to figure out how many people sanction out and how many people will come into the system and by committing crime. So the forecasting methodology is pretty sound given that. But we will ask that question, either the department or I will ask that question and get a response back to the subcommittee.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that might be helpful, we've been doing the forecasting since the implementation of Measure 11. It might be interesting to see an overlay on how accurate the forecasting has been up until now.
Yeah, and I believe that that material is, I think Mr. Wilson might even have that. What I would tell you is that I think initially, until everyone understood how Measure 11 was going to get used, there was, as the forecast was originally being built, the assumption was that everybody who committed a Measure 11 offense would potentially be charged and sentenced with a Measure 11 offense. And what they found was that over time, district attorneys were exercising their discretion, cases were getting pled out that weren't Measure 11, and so those numbers started to drop, and over time became much more realistic. And so I think, as I said before, if you look at the April session forecast, which is the one ultimately that the budget's been built off of for the last three biennia, the forecast has been within about 1%, at least on the prison population side. It's been within about 1% plus or minus the actual at the time, you know, as we've gone through. So that gives us at least some sense that the model that's been developed over at Economic Analysis has been pretty effective in hitting the forecast numbers. Things can change, though, obviously, and certainly the 2003...
Anna, just one, please.
Director Williams, but let's also make sure we understand this graph. If you look at January 05, the number of folks that are in community corrections, let's just call it 32,000. Is that correct? We're close? Is that what we're saying? January of 05?
31,000.
Well, I'm going to use 32 because it makes the math I'm going to do simple. 10 years later, we're going to say it's 37. Right? So that's what the graph says.
Right.
That's only 5,000 people. That's 1.5% a year growth, but we're getting 8% more prisoners. So if you think about it that way, while the graph looks steep, the number of people coming into community corrections versus the number of people coming into the system
right. Is
a small percentage. Anybody dispute that?
No.
I mean, if you do the math, the graph is deceiving because of the way it's laid out and the number of people. But if you look at the growth rate and the number of prisoners coming in versus the people that are going back to community corrections, it's a very small piece.
Okay.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, also on that same chart, Table 8 shows the percentage increase in the community corrections population by year. So it just supports what you're saying. It's a proportionally small increase, and traditionally that's been the case. Our field populations have grown over time, but generally at a pretty moderate rate. The final page has a frightening number of budget totals. So I will try and explain to you in a way that is understandable what the various discussions are right now about what is the right number for community corrections. The traditional model, the model we've been using to build the baseline budget for community corrections, and the reason the baseline budget is important is because that's the level at which, below that level, counties can make a choice to return the responsibility for community corrections to the state. So that is part of statute. The calculation of the baseline budget is specified in statute. The traditional model we've used to do that involves forecasting that local control population, which again is a really small group, about 1,300 people right now, but an expensive group. And then we forecast a number of populations under the supervision site according to risk. And again, that comes from the Office of Economic Analysis. Sue gives us the numbers, and we apply case rates to each of the different populations that we fund. There was an increase in that particular method from October 2004 forecast to the April 2005 forecast because the October forecast was low. And so the April forecast is now higher than the October forecast. Using our traditional method of using the correctional forecast numbers and our different case rates, we get to $190 million. So that's one number that's being discussed as far as the right number for community corrections. In the governor's budget, he has really accepted the recommendations of stakeholders in the community who would like to see us move to a different way of building the baseline budget. Rather than forecasting local control population and many different types of offenders on supervision, we would simplify the forecast so that we're looking at our probation population, felony probation, and that group of offenders who've been to a DOC prison and are now out on supervision. So we have a post-prison group, we have a probation group. We have been using a capitated rate to include in our allocation formula to counties, so they're used to understanding our budgeting based on capitated rates for just those two populations. The capitated rate includes the costs of managing, for example, the probation group, including all of the supervision, all of the sanctions, all of the services, and funds those individuals who end up on local control status from that group. So instead of forecasting local control and funding it separately, it's included in the capitated rate, much like healthcare capitated rates. Try and include everybody, both the very expensive people and the well inexpensive people. The practitioners prefer this method of funding because it provides more stability to the system. Our local control population is difficult to predict, one, because it's small, and two, because it depends so much on local decisions and local practices and local resources. And so Office of Economic Analysis is also supportive of moving to forecasting our population by these two groups rather than the way we've been doing it. You see there band model, old rates, band model, new rates. The old rates, the capitated rates, were set in 1999, and they reflected the cost of managing the average probationer, the average person on post-prison supervision at that time. Practices have changed. Most notably, we're using local control status less often because that's such such a cost driver to our rates. It creates that 197.8 figure, which is much higher than any of the other ways we could think about our baseline budget. Practices have changed, less local control. We recalculated the capitated rates based on current practice in 2004, ended up with a dollar a day difference for probation, which made a significant difference in how the budget builds for the state. And that's the 182 million figure there, 181.9, band model new rates. Same number of people, different capitated rate because of different costs for the profile. So these are the numbers, primarily the 182 and the 190 are the numbers that are being discussed amongst stakeholders about what's the right number for community corrections. And then at the bottom you just see there's a calculation that shows the difference between the governor's recommended budget and the various scenarios for handling the April forecast. And I'm hoping that made some sense, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about it.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out the $190 million figure at the top of the page, or the top grouping, is what's in the House budget, House co-chair's budget, and the $182,928,000 figure is basically what is in the Senate budget. Just to put some perspective on the numbers.
Say that again, could you?
The $190 million at the top of the page is generally what's in the House budget, and the $181,928 is generally what's in the Senate.
Can you explain to us why the co-chairs are using a different number?
It is based basically on different assumptions of whether to use the band model, which is included in the governor's budget, or their traditional ways of doing it. Not surprising, the counties like the $190 million figure more than the $182 million figure.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important, and I'll let Ginger explain, the stakeholders, including the governor's office, but including counties, the community corrections directors and sheriffs, have met and worked out an agreement, essentially, about how we would approach transitioning to the new band model. And I think it would be helpful for Ginger to explain that, because it also explains where the governor's office currently is on this issue.
At our stakeholders meeting, we reached an agreement with those individuals that we would postpone moving to the band model until 07-09. The rationale there is that our current case rates that we use to build any of these models for supervision have not been looked at since for over 10 years. So they've been, they were set 10 years ago based on practices at that time. They've been adjusted for inflation over time, but they've not been restudied to see how closely they're tracking reality. And practitioners think that they're probably low based on current practices. And so it is certainly time to do an actual cost study and try and capture costs of the current system. For example, we have sex offender notification that didn't exist when we did our original assessment, and that certainly adds cost to the work of the field office. So the agreement was that we would do this actual cost study, adjust our case rates and our capitated rates during the interim, and prepare a band model budget for 07-09, stick with the traditional budget building model for this biennium. So there is legislation that will be considered tomorrow that essentially would put that agreement into the statute that governs how we determine the baseline funding for community corrections.
Hey, Rosie.
I have to make, this is a new committee for me, so I will make my statement as I've done in my health committee. And I have a personal challenge to try to prove that prevention works and will eventually save us money. And so I'm going to do a little bit of research with some of the programs that are coming, and I'd love to get some feedback from you all on this too. Because I think of the Children's Trust Fund budget for grants, which is at $5 million, and it's kind of it's set as a trust fund, and they give out grants the interest earned. But they fund programs in communities and have done, and the Children's Commission on Children and Families and things like that, mostly, I mean, almost all prevention, primary prevention programs. And if we could get some of those numbers out to people, I think we could find more money to put in at the front end and eventually turn that thing around so that we're spending less at the back end. Because I'm just appalled at the numbers that we have to spend treating somebody who's had problems or whatever's gone on, that they're in this situation, that maybe we can spend a little bit up front and with parenting classes, whatever these programs are doing, giving helps to people on the front end, so that we can not have these huge numbers to be spending here, and we save our money, you know, for something else, or just save it and not have to spend it.
I can tell you that the majority of the youth and child family programs in DHS all have as one of their intentions and goals helping to prevent problems further on, whether it's Healthy Start, First Start, Beginning Start, Early Head Start,
all that.
Cocoon, Fresh Start, Multiple Start.
False Start.
They're great intentions, and they all have really strong constituencies, and their goal is to raise a child the way that you should, and then they won't go to prison later.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just intervene, Mr. Chair, we certainly believe that prevention is a valid and viable methodology. We're one of the five agencies under Senate Bill 267 that's working with evidence-based practices and programs. Certainly the agencies that you're referring to that are being state-funded, or most of them are falling under that same requirement that they demonstrate that the programs that they're operating are evidence-based. What I also try to remind people as you're looking at these numbers is that, and they are large numbers, that what we're trying to avoid and what the goal of the department is first and foremost is public safety. So while these programs often, alcohol and drug treatment, sex offender treatment, the supervision of the individuals who have committed the crimes, sometimes it feels as though that we're spending a lot of money on somebody who's made a mistake and maybe not even be deserving of those resources. And what I try to remind people, and I hope you would keep in mind, is what we're advocating for is that by some of the resources that are spent in supervision and treatment upon release, that what you're really doing is you're protecting a current innocent Oregonian who isn't a victim of a crime from becoming a victim of a crime. And that's primarily and ultimately our mission, is that public safety mission. You can do that from prevention way before all of this expense occurs as well. But if you don't spend some of these resources dealing with this large population of people we've got returning back to the community, every time someone comes back into the Department of Corrections, it, just the DOC cost for recidivism per individual coming back is about $72,000 per individual coming back into our system. So a little bit of an expense, and when you add it all together, it doesn't seem very little. But some expense following these people back out into the community also saves the overall budget some money by not having to spend money on reincarcerating them when they come back into the system. So it's a balance. It is a balance. And we're happy to work with you, Representative, in any way we can.
No, and I'm totally in support of the treatment, see what happens. I understand how imperative it is to the success of the program, but I would love to put them out of business. Well, I had to leave the committee to testify in another committee in favor of fair budgets, and we started talking about 4-H and how kids are involved in 4-H. You don't get them in OYA, and they don't go to prison usually.
That's true.
It's a real high percentage that stay out of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Martin, I'd like to hear more about this meeting. So this was the stakeholders that met now and decided that they're going to go with the traditional model. And can you discuss or comment on which counties are going to stay in? Are the two that opted out going to come back? And so then the Senate budget will be $9 million short if the stakeholders have agreed and the governor's agreed with the traditional model for the community correction grants. Is that?
Chair Richardson, and Representative Wiffert, that's a more complicated question than it may appear on the surface. Certainly, with the 190 figure, I don't think there can be any argument that that's a baseline figure, and no counties would have the option of opting out at that level, because that's historically how we have reached the baseline in statute. I have no reason to believe that either of the counties that have opted out would opt back in. I think they did that for reasons beyond the financial. And I think it's a legal. We would need a legal understanding probably to look at the 182 figure to determine if that can become the official baseline number below which counties could opt out and above which or at which counties could not. That's the question the legal question that's still out there. And I don't know if, Max, you have a different way to talk about that.
No, I would just say that at the 182 figure, I think you're going to have some counties that are going to want to test the proposition that that doesn't function as the baseline and that would be a basis upon which they would be entitled to opt out. Whether or not that's an accurate understanding of the law or not, I don't know. Certainly, I know that there are some counties currently that have told us that if they're funded below the baseline this time around, that they would likely exercise their opt out, and some of them are larger counties, which would obviously strain to some degree the resources. The two counties that we currently operate, Lynn and Douglas County, collectively have less than 50 employees, and we were able to assume them into the department, and we have a great working relationship and are pleased to have those offices working with us. But as you start to look at larger counties coming in, it becomes logistically a bigger challenge, I think. And so we're hopeful that we can continue to work with our county partners and convince them that...
Are you up to speed on that, Mr. Chair?
Well, I was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I knew that was a big issue then because we were cutting back and some counties were opting out. But maybe you can bring it up. We're going to be running out of time. Are there any other questions that we're going to need to review? This has been informative. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave us with?
No, Mr. Chair, we're pleased to answer any additional questions. I know that Ms. Acuff has been keeping a running log of questions that she'll review with the committee staff to make sure we've got everything that you've asked us for. We'll try to get responses to you in the next several days. Between now and our next invitation to come back and visit you, if there's anything, information that you need, we'd hope that you just feel free to communicate with Mr. Wilson, who we're in touch with on almost a daily basis, whether he likes it or not.
Okay.
At one point in your discussion of one of the options, you said you were going to identify the cons, and I think that's a valuable skill for a person in your position to have.
Thank you, Representative. I'm getting better at it after a year and 4 months, but I'm not perfect yet.
We just want to make sure that we're not getting, well, you know, and that's why I'm concerned about the projections, because the projections We have the alternative, which looks good, except the projections all indicate that it's going to get worse. And so I'm wondering if whatever we're starting to do is going to aggravate instead of solve. And if it's going to solve, then is there any projections that it might do some good? Yeah. And so I'm hoping that that's the case. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if there's no objection, we will adjourn.